This evening we're going to continue with our look at the Four Noble Truths. And tonight we're going to look at the third noble truth. And it's quite simple in one way. And this is from the first time the Buddha ever spoke. This is a quote from this discourse. Now this, bhikkhus, is the noble truth of the cessation of dukkha, the remainderless fading and renunciation, release and letting go of craving. That's it. All we have to do is stop craving and clinging, he says casually, right? I mean, the Buddha said he was sitting under the Bodhi tree and he still wasn't enlightened. And he saw that he still was clinging to a subtle sense of a separate self. And then when he let go of that, when he stopped that craving, then enlightenment arose. So this is like a long-term project, let's put it that way. But it's like really... The question that obviously arises, other than, well, I mean, why is Barry even given a talk with this? All we got to do is stop craving, and I can stop my talk right there, right? But what does it mean to end suffering? The cessation of dukkha, the end of suffering. Right after the Buddha's enlightenment, actually before he even gave his first Dharma talks, he was wandering to go to where he was going to hang out with these five guys he knew who used to hang out with in the forest. And someone saw him walking, and you know the Buddha was like glowing, right? And he said, the person who saw him said, "Who are you?" And the Buddha simply answered, "I am the one who no longer suffers." That's how he described himself. I'm the one who no longer suffers. So that's like a definition, in a sense, of enlightenment. But what does enlightenment mean? Or being enlightened? What do they mean? This is the most difficult question in all of Buddhist teaching. And it's difficult because it's not answerable in words, because words are, by their very nature, dualistic. It's me talking about something. And enlightenment is non-dual. There's just no sense of separation from anything. So we immediately come up with this problem of, well, you know, because we want to, like, just give me a simple explanation, right? You know, just tell me how this really is. There's even in other places that you see, it's said that the only person who can recognize an enlightened being is another enlightened being who can truly know. So, to answer the question, you have to be enlightened. But then you don't have the question anymore. Paradox, right? And so what goes on, and what the rest of this talk is going to be, is looking at ways we can answer this question obliquely, I think would be the best word. Excuse me. And there's lots of ways to do this. One of them is through stories of various sorts, you know, stories that sort of illustrate where we're headed or how we're trying to understand this. This is a book called What the Buddha Taught by Walpola Rahula. It has lots of little gems. And this one is about this. This is a story, the traditional teaching story, but a tortoise and a fish. And the tortoise had been away for a while, and he came back, to the pond, and he's in the pond. And the tortoise told his friend the fish that he, the tortoise, had just returned to the lake after a walk on the land. Of course, the fish said, "You mean swimming." The tortoise tried to explain that one couldn't swim on the land, that it was solid, and that one walked on it. But the fish insisted that there could be nothing like it, that it must be liquid like his lake, with waves and all, and that one must be able to dive and swim there. So it's like trying to explain, you know, there's lots of different stories like this. The frog and the well is another classic one. We're trying to explain something, but we don't have the context. We don't have the experience to understand what someone is saying when they describe it. As wonderful as it might sound, we don't have the context. This is a more recent example of the same thing. This is from David Foster Wallace's book, This is Water. This is just like a really brief little story. There are two fish swimming along, and they happen to meet an older fish swimming the other way, who nods at them and says, "Morning, boys, how's the water?" And the two young fish swim on for a bit, and then eventually one looks at the over at the other and goes, "What the hell is water?" If you don't know you're swimming in water, or that there's any alternative to that, if you don't know that there's something other than the environment you're functioning in, you can't understand the question even. This is the difficulty. My teacher Swami Vishnu, back in the day, used to use this as a classic teaching, another classic teaching analogy. He says, imagine you're trying to explain to someone what honey tastes like. Okay, and you can say, well, it's sort of sweet, and it's sort of tastes like sugar, but not, and you know, it's sort of gooey, but it's not, but it's still liquid, and you can go on forever. But you can never really explain to anyone what honey tasted like. But then you say, open your mouth, and you put a little bit of honey on their tongue, and they know, oh, this is what honey tastes like. But if you don't have the taste, if you don't have the taste of enlightenment, I can talk forever and you wouldn't understand. But of course, philosophical beings, which there are lots of in this world and in past lives, past generations, have tried endlessly to do this. So I want to share a few of these sort of things. One way enlightenment is always described is the end of greed, hatred, and delusion. The three poisons, which are, of course, the cause of suffering, right? So if those things end, and we can sort of imagine that in vague sort of sense, what would it be like to not experience greed, hatred, and delusion anymore? Yeah, we can sort of imagine it, but we don't really, we have moments when we're not in those things, we have some sort of sense of what it might be like, but to have that end, well, you know, it's, once again, who knows? There's also a classic philosophical system called neti neti. Neti neti translates roughly as not this, not this. And the idea behind neti neti is, well, I can't explain or describe what enlightenment is, but I can describe what it isn't. And if I keep just describing what it isn't more and more precisely until I've eliminated everything except enlightenment from my list of things that enlightenment could be, then what's left must be enlightenment. This is like, so it's, well, this body is an enlightenment. Yeah, I can sort of get that. Yeah. What about, but what about my friend's body? No, that's not enlightenment either. What about my mind? What about my, and we go, you go on and on and on and on through these lists of all these things that it's not. But the problem is, you never get to the end of that list because there's always more things for it. We always, oh, well, no, it's not. So you can sort of get close and get an approximation, but you never really get there. Sometimes you see words like the unborn, the ungrown, and the unconditioned. The problem with those words, I think, is that they sound sort of negative. Like, oh, unborn, all these uns. Unborn, ungrown, unconditioned. But negative and positive are in and of themselves relative terms. We think this is positive, this is negative. That lives in the world of duality. And enlightenment lives in the world of non-duality. So thinking something's negative or positive, for that matter, is missing the point. Sometimes you hear the terms relative reality and absolute reality. Relative reality, how we sort of our day-to-day, how we function in the world. And absolute reality is the truth of enlightenment. But we sort of pretty much live in the world of relative reality. And absolute reality is like this interesting philosophical idea. And for some of us, we have sort of brief moments sometimes through practice, through intense practice, where we experience absolute reality. We experience the sense of not being separate. This is what the practice leads us towards over time, is we have a little, not even a taste of honey, but sort of like we get a little whiff of what it smells like or something. And we get some closer approximation, but that's all. But we have these experiences. And then we can sort of understand when someone says, well, this is absolute reality, that we have some sort of little tiny bit of context. Nibbana isn't the result of practice. This is a great one. Nibbana isn't the result of practice because being a result implies process. Starts here, ends there. But Nibbana isn't a result. It isn't like that. It isn't. These are just what various philosophers have said. Okay, I'm done. I'm just trying to give you enough different ways to think about it that some of them might ring for you. There's this place in the sutta. This is the Samyutta Nikaya, and this is on the wrong page. My note has the wrong page here. 670. Oh, there we go. Ah, yes, here it is. So this is in the Samyutta Nikaya. This often in various suttas, some Brahmin or some householder or someone other than one of the Buddha's disciples, and even some of the Buddha's disciples will come and ask him a question. And in this case, this guy Kassapa has come to ask questions. And he's not actually asking them of the Buddha, he's asking them of Sariputta, one of the Buddha's main disciples. How is it, friend? Does the Tathagata, that's the Buddha, exist after death? The Blessed One, friend, has not declared this, the Tathagata exists after death. Then, friend, does the Tathagata not exist after death? The Blessed One has not declared this either. The Tathagata does not exist after death. How is it then, friend? Does the Tathagata both exist and not exist after death? The Blessed One, friend, has not declared this. The Tathagata both exists and does not exist after death. Then, friend, does the Tathagata neither exist nor not exist after death? The Blessed One, friend, has not declared this either. Why hasn't the Blessed One declared, friend? So it's like, here's these four examples, he's either exists or he doesn't exist, and there's all these four combinations of those two things. This is another classical philosophical trick. We're like, let's look at all the possibilities. And this guy figured, well, he's got to be one of these four, right? And this is the answer he gets. Because this is unbeneficial, irrelevant to the fundamentals of the holy life, and does not lead to revulsion, dispassion, to cessation, to peace, to direct knowledge, to enlightenment, to nibbana. Therefore, the Blessed One has not declared this. So on one level, this is like, don't bother trying to figure those sorts of things out. You're just wasting your time. Okay, that's one level of that answer. But the other level of the answer, I think, is even more interesting. And that's that all four of those possibilities point to the Buddha as being a separate entity that's going to exist or not exist at some point. And since the Buddha declares very clearly that he's not a separate entity, he's just part of the whole, everything, he's connected to everything, he's not separate at all. That's part of being enlightened, is to not be separate. Then asking those questions is irrelevant. And that's why they don't lead to anything, because the questions themselves are an incorrect premise. That someone exists now, after death, something's going to happen. I told you this is philosophy, right? I find it fascinating, because it's like, what that sutra is really saying is, there's no self that's going to die. Then is here's one two more. This is a classic metaphor. Imagine the house is oriented east-west. The sun shines in the east, rises in the east, and shines through a window on the east wall. And then that light hits the west wall. So we know, in a sense, what happened to that light. It came through the window and then it hit that wall. But what if there is no west wall? What happens to the light then? Just going forever? It has no end. There's no way of explaining what happens to that light, because there's nothing there. My teacher, Guy, had a version of this. He'd say, imagine you're out in space, way beyond the edge of the planets in the galaxy. You're facing in towards the sun. So you can still see the sun. It's a bright star. That's that big bright star over there. And the light is shining on you, right? But then you turn around so your back is to the sun. And there's just like black void. Where did that light go? It was there, but when you turn your back on it, it's gone. The light just keeps on going. There's also, at the end of the Metta Sutta, there's this line the very last line of it says, if you basically at the end of the sutta it's saying, if you practice this, you'll become enlightened. And the last line is not born again into this world, which means the energy of the karma that you're experiencing in this life, in this body, you're enlightened. That energy, when this body, physical body, goes, that energy goes with it. It's gone. There's nothing like, oh, you die and because you're enlightened, you go to some special place and hang out with all the other angels or whatever, right? It's just, that's all that happens. So, what I'm trying to point at here, just by giving you as many examples as I can of how people talk about this, is there's no, as you can see, there's no real way that I can explain this. I can't explain to you what enlightenment is. I can give you these examples, I can give you ways of looking at it, I can give you pointers to move in the direction, but that's all I can give you. Even if I was enlightened, I couldn't explain it to you because I wouldn't have the words that would make sense to you. Let alone me not being enlightened now, it even makes less sense, right? But it's like, that's the nature of enlightenment, is that it's unexplainable in our conventional, rational world. It can only be experienced. So, how do we approach moving towards enlightenment in our practice? And we're doing this practice because we believe strictly through faith that this leads towards enlightenment, whatever that is. Right? And Joseph Goldstein actually had some really good suggestion or two here. And this is a section in his book, Mindfulness, called Ways to Abandon Craving. That's what we're trying to do. We're trying to abandon craving, right? Regarding the end of craving, the Buddha made a very obvious but often overlooked observation. When we focus on the gratification that comes from sense pleasures, desire increases. When we focus on the drawbacks of sense pleasures, craving diminishes. But how often in the midst of our involvement with the world of sense objects do we pay attention to whether we are further conditioning or deconditioning craving? This would be an interesting practice to bring to the world to see what we could learn from it. So often do we think, oh, sure would be nice to have some chocolate now. And then we go, oh, well, I'm going to better go get somewhere. I go to the fridge and get some chocolate ice cream or something, you know. How do we go, it's not necessary right now. I don't need chocolate. It'd be nice. Might be pleasurable. But how often do we actually pause and go, yeah, I don't need to do that. Just seeing the craving arise and consciously choosing not to satisfy the craving. This could be actually what Joseph was saying, is actually part of the practice. Could be. He goes on. We can decondition, relinquish, and abandon craving through an increasingly refined awareness of the three characteristics. The more clearly we see the impermanence of all experience, the more we understand for ourselves the basic unreliability and ultimately unsatisfying nature of all phenomena. And through a sustained, wise attention, we understand more deeply the selfless, impersonal nature of this whole unfolding process, that nothing lasts long enough to be considered self. These universal characteristics are the drawbacks, the dangers, the downsides of conditioned experience. Thinking that pleasurable things will make us happy. Thinking that things will last. Thinking there's a separate self. These are all things that we get caught in. The three marks of existence is sometimes called. Joseph goes on in his cheerful way, though. Happily, though, there's also an upside. It is precisely because impermanent conditioned phenomena are unsatisfying that we are motivated to awaken. Seeing these characteristics clearly becomes the cause and condition for liberation. The Buddha pointed out this very directly. If there were no danger, beings would not become disenchanted with the world. But because there is danger in the world, beings become disenchanted by it. It can be illuminating to watch our reaction to this teaching. How do we relate to words like danger, drawback, and disenchantment? Do they sound gloomy or fearful? Or by helping us see things more completely, do they bring a sense of openness and relief? It's especially helpful to understand the word disenchantment, because the Buddha often speaks of this as the precursor to awakening. Remember, disenchantment means to wake up from a spell of enchantment. To wake up from the dreamlike state of ignorance. Disenchantment. This is what we're trying to do. We're trying to disenchant ourselves. I mean, what one view is we're just enchanted by the world and all the glories of it and all the things we think about it and all the things that arise in our mind that seem so important. We're just being enchanted by the dual world as opposed to just proceeding towards the non-dual. So that's, and the practice of mindfulness, this is, once we get past the initial stages of practicing mindfulness, which has a lot to do with just noticing what's arising and noticing, now my ear itches, you know, now there's that noise outside, and now I'm telling myself this crazy story, and, you know, that's what mindfulness at the beginning, that's what we're trained to do, right? We're trained to pay attention to what's arising. But eventually, we start to learn to see that all that's ever happening, really, is something's arising, it's there for a while, and then it's gone. And this becomes not an idea, not a theory, but what we're actually experiencing. We're actually experiencing impermanence. We're seeing it for what it is as opposed to having an intellectual conception of what it is. We're actually experiencing it moment to moment in our practice. And once we see impermanence, then the other things follow fairly easily, because once we see that everything's impermanent, it's pretty clear that then holding on to anything, clinging to anything, because we think it's going to make us happy, is ridiculous. Because it's impermanent. It's going to disappear anyway. So why bother? And then further on into that process, it's like, if everything's changing all the time, there's no sense in holding on to anything. Oh, wait, what about this sense of self? Does it make any sense to hold on to that? This is the progression towards enlightenment in the practice of mindfulness as you go deeper into the practice. Then there's another question about enlightenment that often gets asked, and it says, is enlightenment gradual or in an instant? A couple of interesting. This is the book called Satipatthana, The Direct Path of Realization by Analayo, Bhikkhu Analayo. And he's once again using a classic story. This is probably a metaphor, I suppose. It's about a chicken, you know, lays a bunch of eggs and sits on the eggs. to hatch them, right? The chick's sudden emergence from their shells depends on a gradual process of inner development through the hen incubating the eggs. Similarly, the sudden breakthrough to nirvana depends on a gradual process of inner development and mental cultivation. Just as the hen cannot directly cause the chicks to break their shells, can't directly cause, all you can do is just sit there and wait and practice, right, sitting, the breakthrough to nirvana cannot be directly made to happen. Both will occur in their own time if the necessary conditions are in place. You know, if those eggs are there, no hen sits on them, nothing happens. Well, they turn into breakfast for somebody probably, but you know, that's all. So the conditions have to be ripe over long periods of time as things develop. This passage clearly indicates that progress to awakening follows a gradual course. On the other hand, however, several realizations of stream entry described in the discourses take place in a rather sudden manner, usually while listening to a discourse given by the Buddha. There's all these stories about people who come to the Buddha and he teaches them or he tells them, and they, you know, at the very first time he talked to those five guys he used to hang out in the forest, while he was talking, one of them actually became enlightened while he was talking. And the word stream entry here is a Buddhist terminology term, which basically means, oh, only five more lifetimes now. Guaranteed, once you've gone through stream entry, only five more times around. Sign of progress. On considering these instances, it seems almost as if to hear a discourse were sufficient for awakening, without much need to develop concentration gradually and engage in insight meditation. Here, however, it needs to be taken into consideration that if someone had realized stream entry while meditating alone and in seclusion, this did not occasion a discourse and therefore was never recorded. But when someone realized stream entry while listening to the Buddha, the circumstances of the event caused it to become part of the later reported discourse. That is to be expected, that mainly the latter type of stream entry realizations are recorded in the discourses. The same courses do in fact document the potential for insight meditation to lead to the realization of stream entry, which would be a meaningless statement if stream entry were to depend solely on listening to a discourse. Besides, if simply listening to and understanding the discourse were sufficient for realization, the Buddha would not have given so many exhortations to meditate. So, is it instantaneous or is it gradual? Well, it seems instantaneous because at the moment it happens, it seems instantaneous. But so this is one of those yes, but answers, right? And we all have in our practice moments like this that are the beginnings of this enlightenment that we're talking about. We may not be enlightened, but we have glimmers, little moments of, sense of, something happens. I think it's the only way I can put it. Something happens when you're practicing. Something arises and you go, oh. And it's like you're just being put on pause. And you're just sort of taking in what's there. All, whatever your senses and mind are experiencing, and it's all one thing. Somehow or other, it's like it seems not separate. I had an experience like this. I was on a long retreat at IMS, a 6-week retreat. It was fairly near the end, and I was doing all my practice in my room. And so when I finished a long sit, I was sitting for an hour and a half, and then I'd get up and I'd go outside and do some walking. And it was late in the afternoon. It was just starting to be a little dark, like this time of year, essentially. It was about this time of year. And I go, and IMS has these beautiful woods, so I'm just going to go for a walk in the woods, take a walk I've taken dozens of times along the same paths. And I'm just walking, and I'm just sort of like noticing that everything seems sort of touched by this light. And I think, oh, you know, I'm thinking, oh, well, you know, it's dusk, and this is the light of dusk, and, you know, the sun's at a different angle. And then I have to actually stop walking and just stand. And it's just like, you know, trees and grass and ferns and flowers and things. It's like nothing I haven't seen a million times. But there was something about it that was totally different. Only way I can describe it. It was like totally different. It was like, oh. And I think I must have stood there for like 5 or 10 minutes and just took in this experience of everything is, wasn't any separation. It wasn't like trees and grass and ferns. It was like everything all at once somehow. And so this is like, I think, and people have these things all the time, it's part of the practice. You have these moments where it's like, oh, this is what they're talking about when they say, you know, no separation. And it was just like a little glimpse, right? And then, you know, I went and had a cup of tea, and it was like everything being back to normal again, you know? And, you know, probably the next day I was like a total train wreck too, probably, but, you know, just... things just are like this, but this is part of what happens in this practice. It's so gradual. It's a little bit, a little bit, a little bit, a little bit more, a little bit more. That's all that's ever, whatever is happening, that's all that's ever happening. As we keep having more and more moments like that, closer and closer together somehow. And that's where the practice leads us. This is, a book called First Buddhist Woman, Women by Susan Murcott. It's a collection of stories about women disciples of the Buddha at the time of the Buddha. And first of all, it should be pointed out this was like this really radical thing the Buddha did. He said, oh, sure, women can join the Sangha. They're just as capable of enlightenment as anybody else, which of course shocked the culture he lived in. But these women came and practiced. And part of the tradition was when one of the bhikkhunis, the nuns, became enlightened, they'd write a poem that sort of described the moment of enlightenment as best they could. And this is one of those poems. When they plow their fields and sow seeds in the earth, when they care for their wives and children, young Brahmins find riches. But I've done everything right and follow the rule of my teacher. I'm not lazy or proud. Why haven't I found peace? Bathing my feet, I watched the bathwater spill down the slope. I concentrated my mind the way you train a good horse. Then I took a lamp, went into my cell, checked the bed, and sat down on it. I took a needle and pushed the wick down. When the lamp went out, my mind was freed. Instant, there's that moment when something shifted quite dramatically. But I've done everything right. How come I haven't found peace? I've been practicing for a long time. And then all I did was wash my feet. What lets the water run down the side of the slope and put out my lamp? But my mind was concentrated. Causes and conditions were such that enlightenment arose. Seems totally random in a sense, but it's from her practice and her concentrated mind. is one other way of stating it that I like. This is from the Majjhima Nikaya. This is this one particular verse. And the Buddha is talking here about the four Brahma Viharas and how they lead to enlightenment. And he's describing metta. He abides, revealing one corner with a mind imbued with loving kindness. Likewise the second, likewise the third, likewise the fourth. So above, below, around, and everywhere. So he's describing how this person has loving kindness in all directions. This is a classical way of saying that. And to all is to himself. He doesn't neglect himself. He abides pervading the all-encompassing world with a mind imbued with loving-kindness. Abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility, and without ill will. Exalted. Like that's like something that's exalted is like other than normal. In a positive, wholesome way. Immeasurable. We can't imagine how much loving kindness could be there. And abundant. It's like this. It never runs out. It can always be more. It's always more. It's always more. And then without hostility and without ill will, which is the opposite of these three. Not caught by greed and anger. That's a description of enlightenment, what enlightenment is like from the sutta directly. And so I guess what I'm trying to say here is two things. One, I can't explain what enlightenment is, but I can sort of point at it in a variety of ways. Hopefully that's being helpful in that sense. And two, we're all practitioners, we're all serious practitioners. We've all had these moments, sometimes longer than a moment, that might be like a couple of minutes or whatever, or like something just like shifts, and it's like, oh, there's a palpable difference that we experience. And this is leading us slowly, 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 towards more experiences like that, more often, closer together. Then one day we watch the water run out of the bathtub or something. Who knows? Right? But that's the direction we're headed. That's what this practice is about, really. This practice is about moving in that direction. But it's all about the process. We don't, because none of us really have a clue what it means. Right? All we can do is depend on the process to lead us in the right direction. That's all we can ever do. It's just all about doing the practice. And when we have these little moments or experiences like the one I described, they're amazing and they encourage us like, oh, that's possible too. That's possible for that to be more like how I relate to the world all the time. Because I know that experience is there. It's not like some abstract idea I read in a book or someone described how they had some experience. This practice becomes very personal in that sense. To these times when we tune in that way, encourage us keep practicing and maybe keep us practicing more. One last thing, a little bit of poetry never hurt. This is from Dana Fald's book, One Soul. And it's called Center of the Stream. And she's describing, in a sense, the process of practice. Soften, soften, sink into the still center and receive the body's wisdom. Drink it in, feel everything. Can I really risk embodiment? Breathe until sensations rise in a wave. The feelings I've always pushed away now take center stage. Am I strong enough to witness this? Relax. A deep connected breath sends the message, all is well, even as sensations swell. Can I drop the masks and feel the armor start to crack? A parade of stories, needs, and dreams move past. Can I watch them all and not react? This moment is unfolding, whole, unique, felt, and seen. Dare I allow myself to be carried to the center of the stream, where the water is too deep to stand and there are no handholds? That's a pretty good description of the practice.